The fate of the Affordable Care Act once again lies with the U.S. Supreme Court. It announced this week that it would take up an appeal brought by 20 Democratic-led states. Wisconsin is not one of those. A federal judge in Texas ruled in 2018 that the health care law's individual mandate, that's the requirement that people buy insurance or pay a fine, is unconstitutional, making the entire law invalid. A federal appeals court agreed on the individual mandate, but it didn't resolve whether the whole law should therefore be struck down. The Supreme Court is expected to hear the case in its next term, which runs from October to June, so it's unlikely that it's going to be decided before the November presidential election. In 2012, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to uphold Obamacare. Back then, the court said the individual mandate amounted to a tax and thus found the law to be legal. Allison Hoffman is a professor at Penn Law School. Her areas of expertise include health law, healthcare policy, and healthcare regulation. She's also co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, it was a tangled story there going through the courts to come to the Supreme Court again. Let's start with this idea that the individual mandate would kill the whole Affordable Care Act, according to this judge in Texas. What was the argument there?
So the argument there is one based on an idea that we call severability in the law. And the question is, if the individual mandate goes, if the court says the individual mandate's unconstitutional and you have to strike it, can the rest of the law stand without it? Or is it so critical to the entire law that if you strike the mandate, the law no longer makes sense and the whole law must go? As you can imagine, if you know anything about the Affordable Care Act, thinking about this mandate, which was zeroed out, which was zeroed already, so people don't have to comply with it now and the law is still standing, it's really a farcical kind of argument that the law, which has so many provisions which have absolutely nothing to do with the individual mandate, relies so deeply on this provision that if this provision's no longer law, that the whole law has to go. But that that absurd position is indeed what one district court judge in Texas said, and so thus it is a piece that has been threading through the argument. Will that be the fate of the Affordable Care Act? I'm pretty confident no, but it is one possibility.
Yeah, the Supreme Court had previously decided that the individual mandate was a tax, and that was when you still had to pay money if you didn't get health care coverage under the individual mandate. As you mentioned, Republicans removed the money part of it. So with that change, is it possible now the Supreme Court could look at it differently?
They might. I mean, this is the first part of the analysis, which is if the individual mandate is constitutional because it's a tax, if you no longer have to pay a tax penalty, is it still a tax? Is it still constitutional? And so very literally, perhaps it's not. And then maybe you can't uphold it as constitutional on the basis that it's a tax. But the larger question there, which is which is what the dissenter in the Fifth Circuit, the point that she made, which is if what the law says is you hold insurance or nothing, then is there really anything to even argue that that's unconstitutional? It's kind of like advice. You should hold insurance, and if you don't, then nothing will happen. Or, it's a suggestion by the law. And so really what's so unconstitutional about that at all is difficult to know. But that's the first question is, is an individual mandate with no tax penalty, is it unconstitutional? And it's possible the court might say that. That's indeed what the district court said on appeal. That's what two judges in the Fifth Circuit said. And it's possible the Supreme Court might say that. So that's the first question. And then if you say yes, the mandate is unconstitutional, which I think is a stretch of an argument, but you might say yes to that, then what does it mean for the rest of the law is the secondary question.
Let's tackle both of those possible outcomes here. First of all, I guess the court could say, hey, everything's fine the way it is, nothing changes, that we just continue on as we are. But one possibility is, as you were saying, they say, yeah, the individual mandate is unconstitutional, but no, that doesn't kill the whole rest of the Affordable Care Act. In general, if that's their ruling, nobody's going to feel a change from that, are they?
Probably not. So there is a question of degrees there. They might say that the individual mandate is unconstitutional and the entire law doesn't have to go, but there's a few provisions that are so tightly intertwined with the individual mandate that they have to go. And what are those provisions? Those are things like the requirement that insurers issue insurance to anybody who applies. Those are the requirements that say you can't charge people differently based on their health status. You can't exclude pre-existing conditions. Those are the parts of the laws that are the most tightly intertwined conceptually with the individual mandate. So there's this middle ground as well. But if they say the first piece, which you suggested, which is that the mandate's unconstitutional and the rest of the law can stand without it, then nobody will feel a thing. It will feel exactly as it does today, which is a law with a mandate that has been, where the penalty has been zeroed out. If they take the intermediate position, some people will indeed feel that, especially people who have pre-existing conditions or who have conditions that might cause or other characteristics that might cause an insurer not want to issue them coverage.
Talking to Allison Hoffman from Penn Law School, looking at the Affordable Care Act coming again before the U.S. Supreme Court. We're looking at what might change if they rule different ways. Allison, we've talked about kind of the little change, no change options. What if, and it sounds like you're saying this is unlikely, but what if they said, yes, the individual mandate is unconstitutional, and yes, the whole thing's gone. The whole Affordable Care Act is gone as a result. Again, a less likely option, I'm hearing you saying, but where does that leave our healthcare system if that did happen?
I would be shocked if that happened, and it would leave us with a great deal of chaos on the ground. If you think about what the Affordable Care Act rolled out, it was not just changes that made it more feasible for people to buy individual coverage on their own. It was exchanges set up by the federal government in the many states to sell people insurance. It was a huge Medicaid expansion, which has been responsible for the largest number of increases in coverage across the country. It's investments in training and rural health. It's public health investments. All of these pieces, which are pretty far conceptually from what the individual mandate does, would all kind of be wiped out at once. And then what that would mean is everybody would look to Congress and say, well, what are you going to do to replace this thing? And as anybody who follows Congress knows, they're not an extraordinarily nimble organization lately. So they will be slow to respond to that call. But I think that outcome is unlikely, but it would be extraordinarily shocking and disruptive, not just to the millions of people who've gained coverage under the law, but to the hospitals and to the doctors who have adjusted how they do business and who have more business coming in the doors from people who have insurance who can pay for health care than they did before, and for the many people who are trying to improve on the public health system and especially access to care in rural areas for people who are working on health care delivery. It would be disruptive across the board.
Allison, a lot of the focus has kind of been an all or nothing on the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have made efforts to repeal it, Democrats defending it, or maybe looking to scrap the whole thing and replace it with some kind of Medicare for all. I've talked to some health policy people who say, hey, we've got this. We should be working on fine-tuning it, clearing up unintended consequences, finding ways to work within the framework we have. Has much of that happened, though, over the years since the Affordable Care Act passed?
Well, the Affordable Care Act passed a decade ago, and the Obama administration were in charge of the initial rollout of the law and the kind of initial process of seeing, well, how do these things work? What doesn't work well? How do we fix the things that don't work well? So we were just starting to go down that pathway as a country of seeing the pieces that weren't working quite as intended or unintended consequences of the law. And then trying to figure out how do you fix these things. When the Trump administration took office, and largely what they've been trying to do rather than fill in these gaps is dismantle the pieces of the law one at a time. And so, in terms of fixing problems like people who don't qualify for subsidies when they're buying individual insurance or finding it unaffordable, that's one thing you could imagine policymakers trying to fix. But that's not where this particular administration is focused. They're not really trying to find the gaps that are making insurance unaffordable or healthcare unaffordable for Americans and ameliorate those. They're trying to chip away at the law as they can do through the administrative process.
We've seen in Democratic primaries in the 2018 election, Allison, a lot of Democratic voters seem to think healthcare is a big issue as they go to the polls. A lot of candidates selling their various health plans. How important an issue do you see this, especially with what's going on in the court now in the 2020 election campaign?
It will be the number one issue. It has been, as you look at exit polls and what people are saying is on their minds as they're, as they're going to vote, and it will continue to be, especially as you see healthcare is top of the news in many different ways every day. So if it's not, you know, coronavirus, today it's the Supreme Court hearing a case on abortion. It's the Obamacare case. I mean, healthcare is just top of the news. It's top of people's minds. And it will continue to be all the way through this election. Of course, the specific conversation will shift as what we're looking at, you know, is a debate between President Trump and whoever the Democratic nominee is. But the fact that it's top of mind will you know, with all certainty, stay all the way through the election cycle.
We're talking about the 10-year journey of the Affordable Care Act and question marks about its future as the Supreme Court takes up the issue in its next term. And it's a big issue, as we were just hearing, in this current election campaign. Allison Hoffman is our guest. She's a professor at Penn Law School and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope comes out of this U.S. Supreme Court case on the Affordable Care Act? And what do you want to hear candidates for president, candidates for Congress talking about? What kind of options do you want them considering, debating in this presidential and congressional race? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the uncertain future of the Affordable Care Act. The U.S. Supreme Court announced this week it would take up an appeal by 20 Democratic-led states after lower courts deemed the individual mandate unconstitutional. Penn Law School professor Allison Hoffman stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want to see the Supreme Court strike down the entire Affordable Care Act? Sounds like a long shot, according to our guest in this case, or let it go as is. What do you want to hear presidential candidates talking about? Keeping the Affordable Care Act, trying to fix it, repealing and replacing it, Medicare for all, some kind of more available public option? Or do you have questions about what any of those things mean? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think there was an opportunity very early in Trump's administration to do something different with health care. The Republicans were pushing under Romney and Ryan to have more of what's a refundable tax credit for insurance. Trump is not an ideologue. He's pretty pragmatic, and I think he would have went along with it. Problem is the Democrats' Trump derangement syndrome was so strong that they went the direction of resisting as opposed to trying to find a different path to get to the same result of universal health care through refundable tax credit. So I'd love to see someone, you know, bring that plan or that idea back to the forefront during this cycle.
Steve, thanks for the call. Allison, the idea of refundable tax credits for health care, is that something that would have gotten us closer to universal coverage, as Steve was saying?
Well, the concept that people should get, some form of tax credit to pay for health care is what a large part of the Affordable Care Act is based on. And so if you think about the exchanges where people are buying insurance individually, the people who are lower income, who need help to be able to do so, are getting exactly that. They're getting a tax credit in the form of a premium subsidy to buy insurance. And the bedrock of this idea in the Affordable Care Act came from Romney. It came from Massachusetts. So this kind of idea of, you know, what does health insurance look like if it's a compromised version of health insurance is really at the core of the Affordable Care Act. And I think the harder question is, why have Republicans turned away from this idea, which really started as an idea from conservative think tanks and which Romney supported in Massachusetts, instead of trying to make it work better than it does for the people who remain uninsured?
Thanks for the call, Steve. We'll go to Phil with us now in Milwaukee. Phil, hi.
Yes, I just have a comment about health care in general. When I went to work for a living, and I'm going to age myself, it was 1979. The point I tried to make was there was three people in the health care system. It was me, the doctor, and the company. Now it's the company, the people who handle the paperwork for the company, the people who distribute the funds for the company, the multi-conglomerate healthcare facilities and the doctor. Everybody wants to know why healthcare is so expensive. And now you have five people in the pie when you only had two or three at the time. There's probably even more than that.
Phil, thanks for the call. Do you see that as part of the driver of our cost of healthcare in this country, Allison? The bureaucracy involved in the system as we've built it up?
It absolutely is. It's not the only driver, but it's definitely one driver. I have a forthcoming piece, and I call it healthcare's market bureaucracy, because part of why we've gotten to this point is that we've really looked to the market and market players to run our healthcare system in a way that other countries haven't. And it's created many layers of administration that are arguably not creating a lot of value and are adding a lot of cost. Now, the question of what to do at this point is a tough one, and that's some of what you're seeing in the debates over how to move forward at this point is, can you start to unravel this really complicated system that we've built up over so many years, especially when every one of those layers is jobs and is profits and every dollar of the system and cost is profit for somebody. And so then to scale that back and to roll that back becomes really quite hard once you've rolled it out. But it's a way that our system differs from other countries, and it's a large part of, or it's a part at least, of why our system is so expensive.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Penn Law School professor Allison Hoffman about the Affordable Care Act's future as it waits for a hearing in the Supreme Court over a constitutional challenge. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hello. I'd like to talk about socialized medicine. It's a nightmare, okay? It's not regulated. It's the worst dental care a person could ever get. We need the competition of private insurance, okay? And we need to make it so the insurance companies, and so does the legislator, that insurance companies become accountable. We should be able to go to Mayo Clinic, any doctor, dentist, hearing tests, any ambulance. We're paying insurances. We're all going to pay for it. So why can't we have the best?
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. So a couple different messages there. She's concerned about the idea of, it sounds like some kind of a single payer or like government run healthcare system. But it sounds like she wants heavier regulations on insurance providers, Allison.
So it's a complicated set of issues. The thing I would say is something that people don't really understand about a lot of the restrictions that you face in the system now. If you go to somebody and you learn that the specialist you want to go to is out of network, or you get a bill for an ambulance ride because they're out of network, that's a product of the complicated system of private insurance we have. And when you have something like, let's imagine a single-payer system in the form of Medicare for All, that at least that layer of frustration, it's not that the health system would be without frustration, but that layer of frustration disappears, because if you think about the Medicare program, if you have traditional Medicare, you can go to any provider who participates in Medicare. So you don't hit all of these kind of administrative hurdles and restrictions on choosing the provider you want in a way that you do in private insurance. I think that's a misconception people often have about how some kind of single payer system would work. You could try to regulate the private insurers to get them to open up the doors in that kind of way, but really that is contrary to what private insurance is doing, which is they're trying to offer the lowest priced insurance package by, in part, negotiating with a smaller network of providers so they can bring down the price of premiums. It's really like it's a core part of the business model of how private insurance works.
Thanks for that call. Allison, you've written, I think, about the market for healthcare and the idea of consumer choice, and that being complicated because this is such a difficult thing to shop for, healthcare coverage, given all the variables. What are some of the challenges there if we are counting on the market and consumer choice to help fix our system?
So one of the things I've written about is that we definitely have put a lot of emphasis on the idea of choice. And the way that's translated into policy is valuing the notion of choice of health plan. But if you step back from that and you think about what do we really care about and being able to steer our own pathway through the medical care system, it has very little to do with whether my plan comes from one insurer or another or whether it's Medicare. It has to do with being able to go to a doctor who I have a relationship with and care about. It has to do with being able to get the necessary medical care to be healthy and not kind of face financial insecurity at the end of the day, not end up with large bills. So I think that we have really misplaced the notion of where the value of freedom or autonomy exists in the system as resting on this notion of choice of health plans. And there's a ton of evidence that shows that people have a really hard time navigating choice of health plan. It's really complicated. It requires kind of parsing through the kind of health insurance lingo and the complications of the different ways that health plans are structured and the networks that is often indecipherable to you know, even people who understand the stuff quite well. I've tried to help family members figure out what supplemental Medicare plan to buy, a private insurance plan to go along with Medicare. And I understand insurance quite well. And I often, at the end of the day, can't figure out exactly why one plan costs more than another or what doctors you could go to in one plan versus another. So, you know, the notion that this is something that's really valuable, you know, the ability to kind of have to wade through these choices and for many of us make the choice at the end of the day that it may not be the best choice for us. I think it is, you know, really, we really need to push back on that and say, where do we really care about being able to steer our pathway through this system?
And Allison, we'll leave it there and watch as this develops. Thanks to Allison Hoffman, professor at Penn Law School and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. She joined us for a look at the uncertain future of the Obamacare with the Supreme Court picking up a challenge to it in their next session. Up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll add some fun to your oatmeal. Sounds boring? I'll tell you, oatmeal fans, they're really into their oatmeal. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.